Tune Review and Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @TuneReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@tunereview.com. That is information@CUEANDREVIEW.com or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
This is from The National on Friday the 29th of September 2023, from the news section. Scotland's Migration Minister hits out at Suella Braverman. This exclusive article is written by Abby Garton Crosby. The Home Secretary's comments about LGBT refugees are unforgivable, Scotland's Equalities Minister has said. Emma Roddick, speaking on The National's Holyrood weekly podcast, criticised the cynical nature of Suella Braverman's extreme speech in the US, where she called for a dismantling of international protections for refugees and claimed multiculturalism had failed. The Minister for Equalities, Migration and Refugees took particular issue with the comments Braverman made around the LGBT plus community after the Home Secretary claimed that many people were pretending to be gay in order to claim asylum in the UK. Roddick suggested that Braverman was playing to the hard right of her party as part of a leadership bid rather than dealing with facts or reality. I mean, honestly, I was sitting in the Parliament having a conversation about something else when I saw the TV bring up some of her comments, the ones about LGBTQ plus people, and my mouth just fell open, Roddick said. I mean, you come to expect the kind of policies that they're coming out with, but to have so blatantly laid out there, complete lack of empathy, the willingness to throw, not just, you know, migrants, asylum seekers, under the bus. But to bring that kind of negative attention on the LGBTQ plus community, people of colour, it's just unforgivable, really. During her speech to the American Enterprise Institute on Tuesday, Braverman argued for a narrower definition of what a refugee is, claiming that simply being gay or a woman or fearful of discrimination should not qualify people for asylum. It's so divorced from reality because we know that people are persecuted for being LGBTQ, Roddick said. I mean, it's bad enough here at the moment that people are facing higher levels of hate crime, government ministers coming out and saying these inflammatory things about the community, but to then deny this real persecution, putting people in danger for being who they are, is happening in other countries and causing them to leave. I mean, it's just so bizarre. Braverman also told the US think tank that multiculturalism had failed in Europe and threatened social cohesion. She also claimed that the UK's resources were being stretched thin, due to illegal migration, due to high birth rates among foreign-born mothers. Roddick hit back at the suggestion and claimed Braverman was playing to certain elements of the Tory party. She said, I think all of this is rhetoric without facts behind it or reality running through it. It's just about appealing to a certain demographic that they need to engage to win the Tory leadership elections. It's not about best serving the country. It's not about upholding national human rights obligations. It's just about internal party politics, and not one of them seems to be capable of separating themselves from that long enough to govern the country. One of the key elements that sparked outrage from Braverman's speech was her suggestion that the 1951 United Nations Refugee Convention should be dismantled and questioned its relevance. The Refugee Convention not only defines the term refugee, but outlines the rights of those seeking asylum and sets international standards of treatment for their protection. Braverman claimed that a fear of being branded a racist or illiberal has prevented reform of the global asylum system. Her comments were condemned by the UN Refugee Agency. "It's just horrible," Roddick told the podcast. "We keep hearing these suggestions that human rights are dated or not fit for purpose, but that's completely missing the point that human rights are absolute. They apply in all situations to all people. If you allow any group of people to be exempt from basic protections, then we're all in danger." Asked if she believed Braverman's comments would make rhetoric around migrants and refugees in the UK worse, Roddick said, "Definitely. We all have a responsibility to have discussions on these topics in a responsible space, not a space that allows for the kind of hatred that can lead to people being persecuted here, can lead to hate crime and violence. I can't see her in any way taking steps to do that. It's just entirely inflammatory. It doesn't allow for empathy, for understanding. It certainly doesn't contribute to the multicultural integration that she seems to seek." That article was written by Abby Garton Crosby. This is from The National on Friday the 29th of September 2023, from the politics section. Jamie Hepburn slams Westminster Party leaders at Yes meeting. This exclusive article is written by James Walker. Jamie Hepburn has slammed both major Westminster Party leaders at a local Yes meeting. Speaking to the annual general meeting of the Yes Dunbar Group, the Minister for Independence said the choice offered by the Westminster parties is between a right-wing conviction politician in Rishi Sunak and a no-conviction politician in Keir Starmer. He added that it is essential for the Scottish Government to continue setting out an optimistic but realistic prospectus for independence, which would include an economic plan delivered through a series of set-piece events and speeches. Hepburn told attendees, "Independent countries that are like Scotland are both fairer and wealthier than the UK, so with all our resources and talent, the key question in Scottish politics should be, why not Scotland?" The Westminster parties are offering a choice between Rishi Sunak, who has the most right-wing convictions of any Prime Minister in recent times, and Keir Starmer, who seems to have no convictions at all. But Sunak and Starmer are joined at the hip on Brexit, which is causing a big rise in food prices and hitting household budgets. He added, "This makes it all the more essential for the Scottish Government to continue its independence work to demonstrate there is a better future by focusing on core values, equality, opportunity and community. We've already set out a macroeconomic framework, including currency proposals, plans for a modern constitution which will enshrine the right to access a system of healthcare free at the point of need, and a welcoming and inclusive approach to citizenship. Given the economic failure of Westminster, we'll step up our work on the economy through a series of speeches and set-piece events to show in an independent Scotland we can build an economy that works for everyone. We are setting out an optimistic but realistic prospectus for an independent Scotland, a message of hope which has never been needed more." That article was written by James Walker. This is from The National on Friday the 29th of September 2023, from the news section. Lawrence Fox apologises to Ava Evans over GB News comments. This article is written by James Walker. Lawrence Fox has apologised for his comments made on GB News about journalist Ava Evans, saying, "I'm sorry for demeaning you in that way." Actor-turned-politician Fox made a series of remarks about political correspondent Evans, which included asking, "Who would want to shag that?" during a discussion on Dan Wotton Tonight on Tuesday. Both Fox and Wotton were suspended by GB News amid an internal investigation and a probe by regulator Ofcom, who received around 7,300 complaints about the episode. Fox said he was angry with Evans over comments she made on a BBC debate around male suicide, and alleged she had a dislike of men in general, but apologised for demeaning her. Addressing the situation in a video posted to X, formerly known as Twitter, he said, "If I was going to be sensible and I could replay it, I would say any self-respecting man in 2023 would probably be well advised to avoid a woman who possessed that worldview, because she would probably cause him nothing but harm. But what I did say was, you know, I wouldn't shag that, and all that sort of stuff, which is not right. It's demeaning to her, to Ava, so I'm sorry for demeaning you in that way. However angry I am with you still for doing that, and it demeans me because it's not representative of who I am." He also said he expected to be sacked by GB News on Friday over the incident, adding, "I know I'm going to get sacked tomorrow. I'm saying this stuff to clear my own conscience." Wootton previously apologised unreservedly for a very unfortunate lapse in judgment in a follow-up post to an earlier apology, which suggested he should have apologised for what was said during the broadcast. Evans previously said she had received an apology from the broadcaster. That article was written by James Walker. This is from The National on Friday the 29th of September 2023. From the comments section. Rosebank won't make a bit of difference when it comes to fuel security. This article is written by Leslie Riddock. Don't be fooled. Rosebank is a card-carrying disaster for the planet, taxpayers and green energy. And as much as I hate to argue with Alex Salmond, whose contribution to Scotland's wind revolution has been massive, he is wrong, wrong, wrong on the possibility that this deepest black oil field can somehow be made green. Rosebank, off the coast of Shetland, has been granted development and production consent by the UK government's regulator, the North Sea Transition Authority, NSTA, and misinformation about its impact was spreading everywhere yesterday. First, it won't help energy security in Britain or reduce bills. As almost everyone knows, our oil is actually owned by big companies like Shell and BP, which extract and sell it on the international market to the highest bidder. Thus, Britain actually imports 80% of the oil we consume. Rosebank oil will be no different, and the way to reduce dependence on foreign oil is to reduce dependence on oil. Second, there is hardly any gas to be obtained from Rosebank, which may well be just as well, since we have almost no means to store it, thanks to a just-in-time UK government that doesn't invest in gas storage facilities. This year our storage has doubled to 12 days. Whoop whoop. But that compares with 90 days in Germany, 123 days in France, 110 days in the Netherlands, and 0 days in Norway, because they don't use any of the oil or gas extracted by their state-owned company Equinor, former Statoil, but instead sell fossil fuels to gas-dependent suckers like us. Indeed, since 2017, it's been illegal to install heating based on fossil fuels. Instead, the Norwegians use clean hydropower, developed 80 years before Scotland because Norway had no powerful interest group of landowners blocking its development. Ironically then, Norwegian Equinor uses hydro to heat its Stavanger-based HQ, yet now plans to make billions for its country's massive oil fund by developing the Rosebank oil field. You couldn't make it up. The way to reduce dependence on gas is to copy Norway and install renewably powered district heating. Thirdly, Rosebank will cost taxpayers an arm and a leg. An exemption from the climate change levy for companies investing in the North Sea means taxpayers will lose around £4 billion, not likely to be recouped in taxes. Equinor describes this tax break as helpful, while the Institute for Fiscal Studies describes it as a huge tax subsidy. but justified if it creates new jobs? According to Dale Vince of Ecotricity, the £4 billion we have effectively invested in Rosebank will create 1,600 new oil jobs, just 350 of which are permanent. The same money invested in solar energy, 87% cheaper than a decade back, would create 32,000 full-time jobs, improve energy security and lower bills. Yes, there are 70,000 to 90,000 folk employed in the oil gas sector in Scotland's northeast, and their livelihoods do matter. But will 350 extra, new, additional permanent oil jobs off Shetland do more than slightly postpone the inevitable green transition and Scotland's chances of leading the way? Fourth, Rosebank is not green, obviously. The massive project will bust Britain's legally binding net zero targets and the carbon budget and invite legal challenge. Rosebank supporters, including Salmond, suggest green energy might power the new rigs and platforms. Indeed, Alex's only complaint is that the UK doesn't also require Equinor to use carbon capture, as it is in the Norwegian sector. But come on, Alex, that's fiddling while the world burns. Can intelligent people really divorce the extraction of oil from the fact it will be burned, releasing greenhouse gases, Westminster and Holyrood are legally obliged to cut? Over its lifetime, Rosebank Oil will produce more emissions than 56 coal-fired power stations running for a year, more also than the world's 28 poorest countries combined. How will that feel when Rishi Sunak faces developing nations at COP28 in Dubai this November and encourages a move away from oil, coal and gas? Perhaps he'll pull a sickie. Clean wind energy could power the new oil platforms. Wind for rigs is commonplace in the Norwegian waters. But if Equinor does power Rosebank with Shetland's massive Viking wind farm, due to go live next year, British taxpayers will once again pick up the bill. Not one of the UK's 200-plus oil and gas fields is currently powered by electricity, so Westminster introduced a new tax break earlier this year, which means oil operators will get £109 for every £100 invested in wind for rigs, even though oil companies have made record profits since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Equinor posted global profits of more than £15 billion in the first 6 months of this year. Sweet. In any case, wind-powered rigs are a long way off, so Rosebank's early exploration will certainly bust the UK's carbon budget by 10%. And since Rishi Chopper Sunak has already spent part of that budget by delaying the move to electric cars and boilers, there's no room for manoeuvre in the carbon kitty. Finally, even if clean wind energy from Viking does eventually power the Rosebank, Cambo and Clare oil fields, that clean energy will be lost to taxpayers for decarbonising our homes and driving down our bills. The obvious way to decarbonise oil production is to switch away from oil. But that won't happen anytime soon, thanks to Keir Starmer. If elected, he will not revoke the whopping big oil licences being awarded by the Tories, and his announcement seems to have given Equinor the confidence to push ahead with Rosebank and prompted the company behind Cambo to claim it is now in a better position to get the go-ahead. All of this despite a warning from Labour's Shadow Energy Secretary Ed Miliband a few months back, describing Rosebank as a colossal waste of taxpayer money and climate vandalism. In short, the Tories are committing Britain and Scotland to an oil-soaked future, sneaking massive oil fields past toothless regulators, a frazzled public which craves the appearance of normality, and an official opposition that's permanently out to lunch. It's easier for politicians and the public to just go with the manky flow. After all, Green Norway last year overtook Russia as Europe's biggest natural gas supplier and aims to maintain European energy security by drilling in the previously out-of-bounds Barents Sea. more accessible as Arctic winter sea ice melts with climate change. Environmental campaigners at Friends of the Earth Norway, WWF Norway and Greenpeace Norway describes this as embarrassing, extremely reckless and a middle finger to the Paris Agreement. And it is. Opinion polls suggest Sunak has rallied since his cut the green crap speech last week. And a Herald poll suggests readers are in favour of Rosebank by a margin of 5-1. That still doesn't make it right. Do Scots have the courage to see beyond the last throes of the oil era and recognise this moment for the turning point it really is? That article was written by Leslie Riddick. This is from The National on Friday the 29th of September 2023 from the news section. Scottish and Welsh ministers call for climate summit. This article is written by James Walker. The environment ministers in Scotland and Wales have called for a UK-wide climate summit following the Prime Minister's net zero announcements last week. In a joint letter to Michael Gove, who serves as Minister for Intergovernmental Relations in the UK government, Scottish Net Zero Secretary Mari McCallan and Julie James, Welsh Minister for Climate Change, say there was no prior engagement with the devolved administrations prior to Rishi Sunak's announcements a week ago. In a speech from Downing Street, Sunak pushed back the ban on new petrol and diesel cars to 2035, as well as weakening plans to phase out gas boilers and scrapping the requirement for energy efficiency upgrades for homes. The move, which was criticised by environmental activists and some of his own party, was also followed by the approval of the controversial Rosebank oil field near Shetland by North Sea Transition Authority on Wednesday. The letter said, "Despite the far-reaching implications of the announcements made, with substantial changes in policy that will impact progress in delivering net zero and have profoundly negative implications for the environment and economy across the UK and further affect the UK's international reputation, there were no prior engagements with the devolved governments. Given that delivery of the climate ambitions of the four nations of the UK are intrinsically linked, this is deeply unsatisfactory. In addition, almost a week later, it is hugely frustrating that the UK government has not provided the level of detail required by such significant announcements. We would urge you to provide this immediately to enable devolved governments to fully assess the implications." The Scottish government will write to the UK government separately, the letter said, setting out areas in which progress urgently needs to be clarified, while the Welsh Government has already sought clarity. The letter added, "Tackling the twin crises of climate change and nature loss is one of the most significant challenges facing people and planet this century, and all nations of the UK must work in partnership to complete the net zero journey. Delivering progress on net zero requires urgent action and higher ambition from the UK government on issues reserved to Westminster to complement the action taken under devolved powers. The Climate Change Committee has been clear that action by the UK government is important for delivery of climate change targets around the UK, just as action in Scotland and Wales is crucial to UK targets." The ministers went on to push for the summit, chaired by the Climate Change Committee, saying, "Since last week's process showed the weakness of current arrangements, we are now urging you to establish a new, mutually respectful partnership with the aim of developing an agreed four-nation approach to net zero in a collaborative manner. We therefore invite you to commit, in the first instance, to a high-level summit for a four-nation approach, and to agree with us that our statutory advisers, the Independent Climate Change Committee, be invited to chair the summit." That article was written by James Walker.
This is from The National on Monday, 2nd October 2023. From the Politics section. Fair pay agreements may bring progress for workers. By Professor Gregor Gall. Ahead of a crucial by-election this week, in the run-up to an approaching general election, competition between Labour and the SNP is hotting up on an issue which, ironically, pretty much unites the parties. The issue is agreements on fair pay. Labour call them fair pay agreements, while the SNP call them fair work agreements. Fair pay agreements are a new form of setting wages and conditions at sector level, and which first came into use in New Zealand 3 years ago. They are designed especially for sectors in which workers not only experience low pay and poor conditions, but also find it difficult to organise themselves into unions. This may be because of high staff turnover, small and fragmented workplaces, and hostile employers operating with low profit margins. More than a century ago, in what were known as the sweated trades, because of the long working hours, poor conditions and low pay, statutory wage levels and conditions were established. This was in recognition also of a situation in which a higher supply than demand for such workers existed, meaning unions were not much of a position to help. There is then much similarity to what went before, but the key difference now is that unions have a much greater role under fair pay and fair work agreements, because they will be provided with the statutory means to compel employers to bargain with them over pay and conditions at a sectoral level. At a British-wide level, Labour, under Keir Starmer, originally committed to their employment rights green paper called A New Deal for Working People of 2021, to establish fair pay agreements across the economy by empowering workers to act collectively to negotiate higher wages and more security at work through the rollout of fair pay agreements, starting in social care. Fair pay agreements will establish minimum terms and conditions which will be binding on all employers and workers in the sector. But starting in social care seems to have been revised downwards to just starting in the adult social care sector, following the publication of the final version of the document from Labour's National Policy Forum in July. This is because the text of this document promises to publish a full and transparent review of the adult social care sector agreement, after which we will also assess how and to what extent FPAs could benefit other sectors. It's not hard to imagine any other fair pay agreements will also take years to come into existence, or they may not happen at all. All this stands somewhat in contrast to the unequivocal pledge from Scottish Labour's A Fair Deal at Work, current Holyrood manifesto. This commits to roll out sectoral bargaining when in government. Meantime, last month's SNP Scottish Greens Scottish Government Programme for Government included a pledge for introducing sectoral fair work agreements. But it is not just approaching electoral tests which have notched up the level of competition between Labour and the SNP on this issue. It's also because for the first time ever, last month the Trade Union Congress, or TUC, voted to adopt the policy that employment law should be devolved to the Scottish Parliament. This now means it is more likely an incoming Labour government will accede to this, thus allowing any Scottish government to go further. This results from many TUC union affiliates also being affiliated to Labour. Currently, Scottish Labour's policy is to devolve employment law power through British Labour's policy is not to do so. So we could end up with a situation that the Westminster and Holyrood parliaments have pretty much the same powers on employment law. This could mean that the SNP and Labour in the Scottish Parliament would be tested on the sincerity of their commitments to introduce fair pay or fair work agreements. At the moment, any Scottish Government is restricted in what it can constitutionally do on employment matters. Employment law is still reserved to Westminster. This means that the Scottish Government's fair work policy is largely a matter of cajoling employers through voluntary means. The only fair work agreement which exists is in the Scottish Civil Service, where the Scottish Government is the employer. This was created in 2018, covering four already recognised unions. Following the TUC change of policy, unions now have a golden opportunity to extract from both Westminster political parties not only movement towards devolution of employment law, but also the use of it to create statutory forums of sectoral collective bargaining through the economy and society. This would represent a genuine case of levelling up, because unions are most needed where they are absent or are weak. Set up by the Scottish Government, the Fair Work Convention has already identified hospitality, construction and social care as sectors being most in need of the likes of fair pay or fair work agreements. It is here the mettle of Labour and the SNP will ultimately be tested. That article was by Professor Gregor Gall. Gregor Gall is Visiting Professor of Industrial Relations at the University of Leeds. This is from The National on Monday, 2nd October 2023, from the News section. ScotRail scraps peak fares on all services as six-month trial begins, by Ross Hunter. Peak fares on ScotRail services have been scrapped in a six-month trial beginning on Monday. The Scottish Government-funded project seeks to encourage travel by train instead of car and allows people to travel on off-peak fares all day from October 2nd until the end of March next year. Scotland's nationalised rail operator ScotRail said the trial will see massive savings across the country, with the fare from Edinburgh to Glasgow via Falkirk High at peak times dropping from £28.90 to £14.90. The price of a ticket from Perth to Dundee will fall from £14.40 to £9.90, and the fare from Glasgow to Stirling will drop from £16.10 to £9.60. ScotRail said the project, thought to be the first of its kind in the UK rail industry, will support the Scottish Government's ambition to achieve net zero, providing more people with the opportunity to use trains as their primary form of transport. Alec Hines, Scotland's Railway Managing Director, said, "We want to encourage more people across the country to choose rail travel instead of using the car. Everyone at ScotRail is working hard to make sure that this six-month trial will be a success, and we will be monitoring our services and stations daily to see where we have any significant increases in customer journeys. Some services may be busier than normal, so customers are advised to plan their journey using the ScotRail website, app or social media channels. We know that cost and simplicity are critical factors for people when they choose how to travel, and we are looking forward to delivering this fantastic fare reduction for our customers." ScotRail expects that some trains will be busier and will be monitoring services daily. There will be additional carriages on services between Edinburgh and Glasgow via Falkirk High, with every service operating with 7 or 8 carriages. Extra carriages will also be added to services through Glasgow Queen Street Low Level and Glasgow Central Low Level, linking Lanarkshire to Dumbartonshire. Scotland's Transport Minister Fiona Hislop said, "Our programme for government makes clear our commitment to encourage a shift towards sustainable transport. We know there is much to be done in encouraging people back to rail if we are to achieve our net zero targets. This peak fare removal trial is aimed at achieving this by making ticketing simpler, with off-peak fares valid all day. During the trial period, rail travel will be more affordable and accessible, while helping to identify longer-term steps to reduce car use. This is an exciting and unique opportunity to encourage more people to choose a safe, reliable and greener form of public transport. There are some routes where no off-peak fare exists because the same price is available at any time of day, and as such, customers will not see any change in those areas." ScotRail said that one of the most significant impacts of the pandemic was to radically change the commuter market, with a significant drop in the number of people travelling during the traditional peak times. That market is only around 70% of what it was before the pandemic. Scottish Greens transport spokesperson Mark Ruskell, MSP, said, "This is exactly the kind of bold, groundbreaking move that Scotland needs. It is a ticket to fairer, greener railways and will end the two-tier system that penalises people who have no choice about when they need to travel to work or study." He added, "There are households all over our country who will save hundreds of pounds a year as a result of the action we are taking. Every pound saved on a commute is money that can instead go towards heating, eating or other expenses." Kevin Lindsay, Scottish organiser for Train Drivers Union, ASLEF, said, "To encourage people onto trains and away from their cars, we have to make train travel much more affordable, and this is an excellent first step in the right direction. However, ASLEF is clear that while this is just a start, it is just one step and much more needs to be done. If we are to seriously incentivise more people to travel by rail and public transport, then the abolition of peak fares must be made permanent. This is good for working people, good for the economy, and will help Scotland meet its climate targets." That article was by Ross Hunter.
From the National, on Tuesday the 3rd of October 2023, from the news section. Edinburgh Hotel named as best in Scotland in top competition. And this article was written by Adam Robertson. The Balmoral Hotel in Edinburgh has been recognised as the best in Scotland in the category Top Hotels in the United Kingdom. At the Condé Nast Traveller Reader's Choice Awards, the Balmoral achieved the number 2 slot in the UK. It lost out to Lucknam Park Hotel and Spa in England, which received first place. More than 520,000 Condé Nast Traveller UK and US readers submitted responses, rating their travel experiences across the globe to offer a look at the places they anticipate revisiting. The Balmoral General Manager, Andrew McPherson, said, "I am delighted to share that we have been recognised as the second best hotel in the UK at the Condé Nast Traveller Reader's Choice Awards, securing the top spot in Scotland. It is truly an honour to lead such an incredible team to showcase the very best of Scottish hospitality every day. The Balmoral team works hard to provide our guests with unforgettable experiences and cherished memories. The walls of the Balmoral hold a century of beautiful stories, from its opening in 1902 to now, and the Condé Nast Traveller 2023 Reader's Choice Awards has highlighted quite how many of our guests continue to hold a special place in their hearts for this hotel. And that article was written by Adam Roberts. From The National, on Tuesday, the 3rd of October, 2023, from the politics section. SNP posed to ditch nationalist label at party conference. This article was written by Hamish Morrison. The SNP are posed to ditch a long-standing nationalist grouping within the party at their upcoming conference. Members will be asked to back a proposal to rename the Association of Nationalist Councillors, ANC. Councillors are said to have previously been balloted on the change and backed the new name, the Association of SNP Councillors. It is not known how long the old-fashioned name has been around, though it is similar to the Glasgow University Scottish Nationalist Association, which predates the formation of the SNP by 7 years, having been founded in 1927. Many within the SNP feel uncomfortable that the nationalist label and the party is frequently and erroneously referred to as the Scottish Nationalist Party, most notably by former Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Norman MacLeod, a Glasgow councillor and one of the backers of the motion, told The National, "In recent years, many SNP councillors, who, as you know, comprise the membership of the ANC, indicated their wish to modernise the title of the association. Extensive consultation was carried out, including holding an online ballot with a number of options, including retaining the existing name, with various versions of the new name. The result of the ballot, which was conducted using single transferable vote, was that the new name of the Association of SNP Councillors was selected. The change requires adjustment of the constitution, hence the requirement for a resolution to conference. The SNP conference will be held in Aberdeen between October 15th and 17th. And that article was written by Hamish Morrison. From The National, on Tuesday, the 3rd of October, 2023. From the news section. Chicken underpass. Objectors ask if chickens will really cross a road. This article was written by Marie Sharp. A bid to build an underpass for chickens to cross a country road is being opposed amid claims there is no evidence the birds will use it. The proposed 18-metre-long tunnel under the 60-miles-per-hour road near Gifford in East Lothian is being planned by a local free-range egg farm to give their flock more room to roam. However, a report due to go before East Lothian Council's planning committee next week revealed the local community council has raised objections. It says Humby, Bolton East and West Salton Community Council have argued the investment in the underpass is not justified by the egg production operations. We'll close the road for 6 days and lead to visually inappropriate road safety barriers. They added, there is no evidence exists to indicate that hens will use an underpass to access additional range space. East Lothian Eggs Limited, which is based in Howden Farm near Gifford, was last year given the go-ahead to double its flock from 32,000 chickens to 64,000 by adding a new shed. But they said they now need to find a way for the flock to be allowed more space to meet free-range standards by spreading their wings into a field on the other side of the road from their current home. In the application to East Lothian Council, their planning consultations, Cogio said, the farm needed to provide a minimum ranging area of land outside the sheds. A road safety report on the plan said the underpass would be used by the chickens to roam on either side of the 60 miles per hour rural road and would have openings which would be 2.5 metres wide and 1.5 metres high. The application, which is recommended for approval by planning officers, has been called before the meeting of elected members by a local councillor, Donna Collins, due to the local concerns raised about the application. The report from planners says, as well as the community council objections, the council has received one public objection to the plans, claiming a lack of information about the proposal. had been put forward and pointing out the farm owners knew they would need the additional space before expanding their flock. Planning officers recommended the plans for approval, pointing out it falls within the demand of the local development plan. And that article was written by Marie Sharp.
From the National, Tuesday the 3rd of October, from the culture section, BBC Breakfast cuts off as heckler shouts scrap the licence fee, by Molly Court, SEO reporter. BBC Breakfast dealt with a chaotic moment on the show on Tuesday morning as it was interrupted by a heckler who shouted scrap the licence fee. Presenters Sally Nugent and John Kay were hosting the programme, which featured a live slot from a reporter in Manchester, where the Conservative Party conference is currently taking place. In the news segment, Peter Roddick spoke to Sally and John from Manchester Piccadilly train station to talk about the HS2 from Manchester, which recent reports suggest is going to be scrapped. But it was only a few seconds into the report when a man appeared on camera. Peter began by saying, "From train strikes to delays and cancellations, passengers here are fairly used to uncertainty these days. There has been in recent days a palpable sense of a lack of surprise around these reports." As he went on to talk about the concerns of cost and delays towards the HS2 project, a man barged into Peter and shouted, "Slash the TV licence fee, you greedy vulgar." The member of the public wearing a high-vis jacket and hat was soon drowned out before the camera cut back to the studio. Sally soon jumped in and said, Peter, we're having a bit of unwanted attention there, so let's move on, shall we, for a moment? BBC One viewers were quick to have their say in social media, as some took to Twitter saying, "Oh dear." One account posted, "Most sensible thing said on TV this morning, scrap the TV licence fee, hashtag BBC Breakfast." Meanwhile, this person wrote, "Absolutely dead at the man who was screaming about the TV licence on hashtag BBC Breakfast just now. Been a while since I've had that on the beep. Hashtag BBC Breakfast," added another. Another tweet said, "Oh dear, hashtag BBC Breakfast. Made my morning," shared a user. And that report was by Molly Court. From the National, Tuesday the 3rd of October, from the culture section, comment, "Can Hollywood actors stand firm as AI threatens to rob them of roles?" Article by Shona Craven. There was good news last week for fans of Hollywood films and TV shows when a 5-month strike by the Writers Guild of America came to an end. The bad news is that while the writing of scripts has resumed, it's unclear when unionised actors will be available to deliver the lines. Yesterday, the actors' union got back around the table with the production companies for the first time in 2.5 months. They will be buoyed by the success of their writer colleagues, who achieved what union leaders called an exceptional deal, but some are urging caution. The actors have different demands and face different threats as artificial intelligence improves at an alarming rate. It was perhaps no coincidence that Tom Hanks chose Sunday to post on his Instagram account about the apparent misuse of AI to create a video using his image. Sharing a still image, the actor wrote, "Beware, there's a video out there promoting some dental plan with an AI version of me. I have nothing to do with it." Despite numerous news outlets picking up on the post and reporting on it, I haven't managed to track down the video in question. Based on the screenshot, it appears to feature a heavily airbrushed version of Hanks from at least a decade ago. No offence, Tom. Given he's one of the most recognisable actors in the world, it's probably safe to say that few people would really be duped into thinking he had recorded this endorsement, or, if he had, that it would still be in use in 2023. I'm not telling you that Tom Hanks faked his own deepfake to prove a point ahead of the crucial negotiations between the Screen Actors Guild, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, ACG, AFTRA, and the Studio Association Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, AMPTP. But it's not an impossibility, is it? When the latest series of Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror dropped on Netflix in the summer,
the writer's strike had already begun. In the first episode, titled Joan is Awful, the actress Salma Hayek, played by Salma Hayek, discovers that her likeness has been used in a TV show without her knowing. She was playing the lead role despite never having read the script or walked onto the set, because at some point she had unwittingly signed away the full rights to use of her face, body, voice and name. Far-fetched? Not according to an article published in Variety a month later, which described extras or background actors being asked to submit to 3D scanning of their bodies during a shoot. An extra claimed he was told he would not be paid if he did not cooperate, and that the scans would be used for continuity and special effects, but that he subsequently felt duped and concerned that he might have helped make himself redundant. The studios deny any underhand practices, but it's understandable that performers are anxious. In the Black Mirror episode, Hayek enlists a lawyer to release her from the contract that essentially spells the end of her real-life acting career, only to be told there is nothing to be done. The AMPTP says this is the stuff of fiction, but Variety quotes the small print to which extras from Central Casting, the biggest background actor casting company in the United States, and it does appear very broad, referring to all rights of every kind in nature and uses throughout the universe in perpetuity to all media, whether now known or hereafter devised. SAG AFTRA has a broad membership, including actors, dancers, singers, DJs, puppeteers, stunt performers and voiceover artists. Its members are not necessarily opposed to the use of AI, for example, to produce even more impressive stunt sequences or to match screen actors' lips with the words of those who dub films into different languages. But they fear studios might go a step further by getting rid of humans altogether. Beyond Hollywood, dubbing artists from around the world have been joining a Don't Steal Our Voices campaign, calling for laws against the use of their voices without consent, including for the teaching of the AI platforms that might eventually replace them. But will it be possible to prove that one's voice, or image, or art, or ideas has informed the AI? And, if so, will there be any legal recourse? Yesterday was an AI day of action, with calls for the US Congress to ban large corporations from getting copyrights on art made with AI, but it seems to have gained little traction. The tech is sprinting ahead of the law. Tom Hanks was being too modest when, in May, he told podcaster Adam Buxton that if he starred in films beyond the grave via the use of AI, there would be no way to tell that it wasn't really him. Challenged on this, he changed his tune and posed a depressing question. Without a doubt, people will be able to tell. But the question is, will they care? Audience might feel shortchanged by an AI leading man, but perhaps less so by an AI generated crowd scene or stunt. Will we, as viewers, be entitled to know how the movies and TV shows we watch have been made? The next few weeks could have huge implications for what we see on screen in the years to come. And that article was by Shona Craven. From The National, Tuesday the 3rd of October, from the culture section, independence is normal. Independence is normal. Iraqi identity lost for a century. Article by Laura Pollock. Today marks the 91st anniversary of Iraq's independence, with the date itself chosen as a neutral day for a divided country. Iraqis did not have a national day from the US-led invasion in 2003 until 2020, when the government selected a date so the public can celebrate Iraq. Finally, Iraq will have a national day and the public can celebrate because, since 2003, we have not had a day to celebrate Iraq, Jabir al-Jaberi, a member of the parliament, told social media. Al-Jaberi said that prior to 2003, Iraq's National Day was associated with inter-Iraq political changes, the overthrow of the monarchy and, later, the establishment of the Ba'ath Party. July 14th to mark the 1958 revolution, and July 17th to celebrate the Ba'ath Party, were both celebrated prior to 2003. Now, October the 3rd, the day already observed in Iraq for when the country gained independence from Britain in 1932, and became the 57th member of the League of Nations, has become their national day and a public holiday. It was chosen for its neutrality in a country that, in the last century, has had 9 flags, 5 national anthems, 10 constitutions, and countless controversial national days. New Lines Institute called this a historical process that tells the story of Iraq's lost national identity. So how did Iraq get lost? As a post-Ottoman state, Iraq was granted under a mandate by the League of Nations to the UK to govern the nation in 1920. Britain had already seized Iraq from Ottoman Turkey during World War I. For 17 years, Britain ruled over the Arab nation. However, forces battled for over a decade to pacify the country using airplanes, armoured cars, firebombs and mustard gas. Later, the country was more often than not embroiled in war, used by superpower nations for resources and position in the Arab Peninsula, as well as by their own leaders for their own gains. What was it all for? Well, mostly oil. A monarchy was organised under British protection in 1921, an Anglo-Iraqi treaty signed in 1922, and oil deal signed in 1925 all exemplified British control. The oil agreement granted Iraq token royalties from any future oil revenues, but denied the state a share in the Turkish Petroleum Company, dominated by the British. Saeed Abarish, a writer in Arab Affairs and former consultant to the Iraqi government, described the deal. The agreement between the British and Iraq regarding the rights to the oil of the country is one of the most criminal documents I have ever read in my life. It is aimed at keeping Iraq in the Dark Ages. In 1927, oil began to flow and, as King Faisal I attempted to forge an identity for Iraq, Britain could see its power waning. They negotiated independence in 1932, but not without protecting their oil and military bases in the country. Iraq was responsible for its own defence, but Britain's air bases and the right to move troops through Iraq in the event of war remained. Britain would also train the Iraqi military and supply it with equipment. The king, appointed by Britain and who had attempted to walk the line between the UK and Iraq, recognised his own failure to forge a common Iraqi identity and died while seeking medical treatment in Switzerland in 1933. The Second World War began and, as countries took sides, Iraq rebelled against the pro-British Regency to support Germany. Britain once again entered the country, appointed politicians sympathetic to their control, and quelled the rebellion to secure their own pipeline of resources. It wasn't until 1958 that the monarchy was overthrown, leading to 10 years of coups and instability. A darkness overcame the country, with the establishment of the Ba'ath Party and the rule of Saddam Hussein. General Saddam Hussein became Iraqi dictator in 1979. Blinded by his dream to achieve hegemony over the Persian Gulf, the dictator led his nation through multiple international conflicts, including the Persian Gulf War. With the US government on high alert to the movement of Arab states following the 9/11 attacks, government officials concluded, based on what has since been proven as flawed intelligence, that the general may provide terrorist groups with chemical or biological weapons, and though the Iraqi leader allowed the UN weapons inspectors to visit Iraq in November 2002, his failure to cooperate fully with the investigations frustrated the US and UK. President George W. Bush called on Hussein to step down. He refused, and the US led an attack on Iraq on March 20, 2003. The war resulted in between 151,000 and 1.2 million Iraqis being killed, and the US forces withdrew in 2011. Amongst Islamic division, covert US nuclear operations, and increased religious ideological tension, climate change and youth-driven unrest, demanding better governance in a nation they, and multiple generations before, have only ever seen embroiled in war. The strength of the next generation strongly suggests that the Iraqi national struggle is alive and kicking, writes Dr. Leah Al-Khatib, Iraq's former electricity minister. What can Scotland learn? By celebrating an old Independence Day, Iraqis are given back a shared belief, a shared identity, that through collective effort, they can regain sovereignty after being used for international proxy struggles. resources, both natural, oil, and military, weapons of mass destruction, in Scotland, will be major factors in the power struggle for a just independence agreement, and the UK will be prepared to battle for decades to retain it. And that article was written by Laura Pollock. For The National, Tuesday the 3rd of October, from the culture section, Scotland's first female police drivers recall No Chaperone Freedom, by Laura Pollock. One of the first female police drivers in Scotland told of her joy at being able to do her job without a male chaperone after she helped smash the glass ceiling in the 1950s. Mary D'Arcy Kincaid, 91, started out as a police officer in Edinburgh in 1953, at a time when women had to rely on male colleagues for a lift or get the bus. 3 years later, she saw a job advert for police drivers and applied as it did not specify a gender, although it was aimed at men. She applied and found discussions with her then chief inspector. She was accepted onto the course, but recalled some resistance from colleagues. In 1957, she went to Cyprus for a year, along with three other women officers, to help with recruiting and training female police officers there, and to assist with searching women at roadblocks. She was promoted to sergeant and returned to Edinburgh in 1958, where she worked for 2 years before joining CID. She was one of two women who formed the first crime team for City of Edinburgh Police in 1961. Photographs showed her wearing a skirt suit as part of her uniform and posing with a police dog. Mary, who now lives in Gloucestershire, returned to Edinburgh to be given a tour of her old patch and visited St Leonard's Police Station, made famous by Ian Rankin novels. She recalled her joy at the freedom she felt being able to drive a CID vehicle. After she moved down south, she served as a magistrate in Westminster, and she has been married for 53 years. Assistant Chief Constable Emma Bond praised Mary for driving progress in the police when she joined 70 years ago. Mary said, "I was so excited when I sat my entrance exams and passed, and so began my City of Edinburgh police journey. When the memo circulated inviting applications for police drivers, I thought, why not? After all, they had not specified male or female constables, so I took my chance. I loved driving and knew I could do it well as part of my role. Despite some reluctance from some colleagues, I couldn't believe it when I was invited to go for my driver training. I passed with flying colours, and so my driving as a police constable began. This really meant that I no longer needed a male police constable to drive me to a job, take a bus, or walk. I could drive one of the many CID vehicles. Senior officers, including Bond, were in attendance at St Leonard's Police Station to greet Mary and her family before taking her on a tour of her former beat. Bond said, "Welcoming Mary and listening to her experiences and perspective was a real pleasure. Much has changed to improve the representation of women in all ranks and roles in policing over the course of the last few decades, thanks to inspirational figures like Mary, quite literally, driving progress. Police Scotland is absolutely determined to continue to build on the progress led by trailblazers like Mary to address sexism and discrimination in policing and across society and improve experiences for our officers and staff and the people who we serve." And that report was by Laura Pollock.
The National Politics on Wednesday, the 4th of October. Chris Packham launches a legal challenge to Rishi Sunak. An article written by Laura Pollock. Chris Packham has sent a legal challenge to the Prime Minister over his decision to delay the phase-out of new gas boilers and petrol and diesel cars. If Rishi Sunak does not reverse the changes he announced last month, Mr. Packham said he will apply to the High Court to challenge this in a judicial review, arguing that such a delay is unlawful, given the government is required to follow a series of carbon budget plans on the way to becoming net zero by 2050. The Prime Minister said the sale of new fossil fuel cars will not be phased out in 2030, but in 2035, and that only 80% of gas boilers will need to be phased out by that date, instead of 100%. He said that because the UK has so far decarbonised faster than other developed countries, it can afford to relax its net zero policies, telling the country that the approach to net zero is imposing unacceptable costs on hard-pressed British families that no one was ever told about. Mr. Packham said that this change of direction was made without any public consultation, without informing Parliament or the Climate Change Committee, which advises the government on how to meet its carbon budgets. He said the Prime Minister is playing populist politics with the future of life on Earth, adding, even before this spontaneous, ill-judged and, we contend, unlawful announcement, the UK government's plans to meet its legal net zero commitments were shambolic and destined to failure. Its own Climate Change Committee's last report said that continued delays in policy development and implementation meant reaching those targets was increasingly challenging. It also highlighted a lack of urgency across government, a worrying hesitancy and a lack of political leadership on the climate issue. The committee said it is reviewing the impacts of Mr. Sunak's decision, but its chief executive, Chris Stark, has previously said that the government was already going slow on rolling out electric cars. Any changes to carbon budgets have to be made according to a process in the Climate Change Act, which also requires the government to set out how it will meet the upcoming sixth carbon budget, which Mr. Sunak has not explained. Mr. Packham also said that when Mr. Sunak complained that the last carbon budget was voted through without any proper consideration, he failed to mention that he was Chancellor when the sixth carbon budget was set, with the Treasury playing a key role. He said, reneging on a clear-cut, measurable and guaranteed means of reduction without offering real alternatives to balance the targets is reckless and irresponsible. And he's claiming this is about protecting the poorest in society. It's worth noting that when the policies were enshrined in law, they were signed off by the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and that was Mr. Sunak. The Prime Minister has 14 days to reply to Mr. Packham's letter or reverse his decision before the naturalist and television presenter goes to the High Court. A UK government spokesperson said, "We are on track to deliver our net zero commitments set out in law and are taking a fairer and more pragmatic approach to meeting them, easing the burden on hard-working businesses and families. Households will have more time and flexibility to make the transition, ensuring that they can switch to electric vehicles when it suits them, and easing the boiler phase-out will save some families thousands of pounds at a time when the cost of living is high." An article written by Laura Pollock. The National News on Wednesday, the 4th of October. One of Scotland's best-known business figures dies aged 80. An article written by Adam Robertson. Nick Koonsberg, one of Scotland's best-known business figures, has died at the age of 80. Business angel and mentor Mr. Koonsberg, the father of BBC journalist and presenter Laura Koonsberg, led textiles giant Dawson International in the 1990s when the then stock market listed group owned Pringle. He chaired many Scottish businesses over the decades, including carpet manufacturer Stoddard International, cloud computing company Iomart and Glasgow-based plant and tool hire group GAP. He sat on the boards of Scottish Power and Standard Life as a non-executive director. Mr. Koonsberg, who is a former chair of Glasgow School of Art, also chaired the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland. The Conservatoire said in a statement, "We're so incredibly sad to hear of the death of our former chair, Nick Koonsberg. Nick was the most passionate advocate for and supporter of the RCS community, as well as a welcome and regular presence around our campus. He believed wholeheartedly in the power of the arts to transform individual lives and communities, and was a proud Glaswegian. We'll miss him terribly, and our love and thoughts are with Sally and his family." An article written by Adam Robertson. The National News on Wednesday, the 4th of October. Review finds that Police Scotland officers don't all have vetting records. An article written by Laura Pollock. Some Police Scotland officers have no vetting record, a watchdog has found. A review of the force's vetting procedures found no requirement for vetting the rank-and-file officers and staff to be repeated beyond recruitment checks. His Majesty's Chief Inspector of Constabulary in Scotland, Craig Naylor, said that this is a significant risk and called for all personnel to be re-vetted at least every decade. He said, "I don't believe that any officers or staff should be able to go through the entirety of their service, having only been vetted at the time of their recruitment." Police Scotland Deputy Chief Constable Alan Spears said a re-vetting programme is being introduced. The His Majesty's Inspector of Constabulary in Scotland review found that before the single force was created in 2014, vetting was varied, inconsistent and not always recorded effectively. But since the late 2000s, this has improved and vetting currently conducted is of a good standard. The report states, no check nor review of officers and staff employed by the legacy forces was carried out when the new organisation began, and some have no vetting record. There is no clear process for Police Scotland workers to advise of a criminal conviction or a significant change in personal circumstances, such as a new partner or a new address. It also found a disproportionate number of cases where the appropriate refusal of vetting has been overturned and clearance granted. The watchdog flagged these historical cases to Police Scotland's force vetting manager and the anti-corruption unit so that they can assess risk and whether clearance remains appropriate. Among 15 recommendations, Mr. Naylor called for a new law to be created by the Scottish Government to ensure a minimum level of vetting for all in Police Scotland and to enable the Chief Constable to sack anyone who cannot maintain suitable vetting. He also called for annual integrity reviews to be held, which would note any change in personal circumstances to help identify risks. These changes would be prioritised above the random review of recruitment vetting for 3-5% of officers and staff, which Police Scotland has already announced, the watchdog said. Mr. Naylor also called for vetting clearance to be reviewed following misconduct proceedings. He said a thorough and effective vetting regime is vitally important to assess a person's integrity, and it reassures the public that appropriate checks have been carried out on those who are placed in a position of trust. There is no doubt that the public's confidence and the reputation of policing has been damaged by officers who have behaved inappropriately and broken the law. Significant steps have been undertaken following recent high-profile cases in England to ensure that officers and staff have been checked and any risks identified, highlighted and managed appropriately. Losing intelligence to terrorists or serious organised criminals is a threat which Police Scotland rightly takes seriously, but exposing a vulnerable person to an individual who wishes them harm is, to me, abhorrent, and steps need to be taken to provide assurance that the protection of the vulnerable is prioritised. The Inspectorate independently reviewed 870 vetting case files which had been completed by Police Scotland's Force Vetting Unit staff between 2019 and 2022. Deputy Chief Constable Spears said, "The safeguarding of our values and standards has never been stronger, and the Inspectorate rightly highlights the high standards of our vetting. Over 5,000 officers and staff are vetted to an enhanced level with annual reviews, and we will ensure all roles have the right clearance levels. We've invested to enable additional checks for new recruits before they're sworn into office, and working with staff associations and unions, we're introducing a programme of re-vetting. We know that the onus is on us to earn public confidence and will carefully review this report to identify any further improvements which can strengthen our vetting." An article written by Laura Pollock.
From The National, Thursday the 5th of October, from the politics section, First Minister's Questions. Hamza Yousaf apologises after branding Douglas Ross a liar. Report by political reporter Hamish Morrison. Hamza Yousaf was repeatedly ordered to apologise during a fiery First Minister's Questions after accusing Scottish Tory leader Douglas Ross of lying. The First Minister said the Conservative Party were in their conspiracy phase and said Douglas Ross had been peddling lies during an exchange on funding for Police Scotland. Ross had argued that police numbers were unacceptably low, citing a warning from the head of the police union, who claimed earlier this week that police numbers were so low as to cause a risk to people's lives. It is generally considered unparliamentary language to accuse another Member of Parliament of lying, and Presiding Officer Alison Johnson repeatedly ordered USAF to apologise for the comments. USAF said the number of police officers in Scotland was higher per head than in England or Wales, and that the crime was declining under the SNP rule north of the border. Murders fell to their lowest ever level in record in 2022-23, and overall levels of crime reached their lowest level since 1974 last year. In his closing question, Ross said the First Minister was being sly and sleek-it about the financial pressures facing Police Scotland, saying that USAF was a criminal's dream. He said, "Well, the First Minister flipped through his folder a lot, but couldn't find an answer, which seems to be the only thing constant in this session, because Hamza Yousaf is forcing Police Scotland to close dozens of stations, but he won't say where. He's leaving them with no option but to stop investigating every crime, but he won't say which crimes. And he's forcing the police to cut officer numbers to the lowest level in record, but he won't say how low. Now, for a First Minister that loves the sound of his own voice, it seems quite bizarre that he is silent when it really matters. Silent on all of those questions. Let's just be very clear. Hamza Yousaf is a criminal's dream. He doesn't want them stopped, he doesn't want them caught, and he doesn't want them in jail. Why is he being so sly and sleek-it and secretive about the consequences of the SNP's cuts on Police Scotland?" Yousaf retorted that Scotland had better levels of policing than in England or Wales, and went on to say the Scottish leader's lies about the police service simply will not wash. He said, "I think Douglas Ross is just jealous because nobody likes the sound of his voice, I'll tell you, Presiding Officer. I know the Conservatives are on the post-truth stage. A UK government that is out of ideas and, I hope, out of time very, very shortly. But let's stick to the facts, because the facts tell us this, that there are more officers per head in Scotland than in Conservative-led England and Labour-led Wales. Crime is down under this government. Officers are paid more fairly and, in fact, are the best paid in the entire UK. So I know Douglas Ross, despite having three or four or five jobs, I've lost count, Presiding Officer, was down at the Conservative Party conference this week, or, as others have rightly dubbed it, the Conspiracy Party conference. His post-truth, his lies about the police service simply will not wash here in Scotland, Presiding Officer. His comments drew the ire of the Presiding Officer, who called on the First Minister to apologise three times. She said, "First Minister, as all members are aware, it is wholly inappropriate to suggest that another member of this Parliament has lied, and I would be grateful, First Minister, if you might apologise." Yousaf doubled down, saying, "I'm happy to call it a deliberate inaccuracy, Presiding Officer, because that's clearly what it is." The Presiding Officer again asked the First Minister to apologise, to which he replied, "Happy to apologise to anybody who's been offended by post-truth that have come from the Conservative Party, and to anyone that's been offended by my remarks, Presiding Officer." She reiterated her demand, saying, "I would ask that you apologise to myself and to this chamber." Yousaf finally relented, saying, "I'm happy to apologise to the chamber for any offence caused, Presiding Officer." Police officer numbers have tended to decline slightly since the creation of Police Scotland in 2013, but took an enormous fall during the pandemic. There are 16,600 full-time equivalent, FTE, police officers in Scotland, according to statistics published in August, down from 16,644 PTE. There are 16,600 full-time equivalent, FTE, police officers in Scotland, according to statistics published in August, down from 16,644 FTE police officers in figures published in February. And that piece was by political reporter Hamish Morrison. From The National, Thursday the 5th of October, from the news section, Nicholas Rossi. Scottish Government signs off extradition of US rape suspect. Report by Adam Robertson. The Scottish Government has signed an extradition order for the US rape suspect, Nicholas Rossi. The man is wanted in the United States in connection with alleged offences, including rape and contested moves by authorities to have him flown over to face legal proceedings. Scottish ministers made a final decision to sign the order on September 28th, a response to a Freedom of Information request revealed. Rossi is wanted by authorities in Utah for allegedly raping a woman in 2008. He also faces multiple complaints against him in Rhode Island for alleged domestic violence. A court ruled in August there was no impediment to the 35-year-old being extradited, and the decision was then placed before the Scottish ministers. Despite a court ruling last November that he is Rossi, he insists it is a case of mistaken identity and that he's an Irish orphan called Arthur Knight. And that report was by Adam Robertson. From the National, Thursday the 5th of October, from the news section. Pets to receive blessing at Church of Greyfriars Bobby by Lucy Garcia. People are being invited to bring their pets to an annual blessing service at a church famed for its connection to Greyfriars Bobby. The service, open to anyone, will take place at 3 p.m. on Sunday at the Greyfriars Kirk in Edinburgh. The faithful terrier, known as Greyfriars Bobby, stayed by his master's grave in the kirkyard for 14 years after his death in 1858. In tribute to the dog, who is also buried in the kirkyard, members of the Skye Terrier Club will join the event. Previous years have seen dogs, cats and even miniature ponies attending the blessing. Sue McGregor, who is a probationer minister at Greyfriars and has organised the event, said, "I am delighted to be creating our service, which coincides with UNESCO World Animal Day and the Feast of St Francis. It will be great to see folk from all walks of life along with their pets and to welcome interfaith representatives as we celebrate the world's value and diversity together. There will be a parade of the animals around the kirkyard after the service. Edinburgh Interfaith Association will also be taking part in the event. It will be the last time Reverend Dr. Richard Fraver presides over a pet blessing at Greyfriars, as he will be retiring from his role as a parish minister later this year." He said, "For many, the presence of animals is one of the great blessings of life, overcoming loneliness, reducing stress and providing profound companionship. Visitors to our church are often drawn to the qualities of love, loyalty and companionship found in the story of Greyfriars Bobby, which is a lovely thing to celebrate and honour. The pet blessing is an opportunity for people to express their gratitude, not just for the pets they have, but for the idea that we share life and plants and, with plants and animals, reminding us of our duty of care to the whole of creation." Greyfriars Bobby belonged to night watchman John Grey, who took on the dog to keep him company through the long nights. But Grey contracted tuberculosis and died of the disease on February the 15th, 1858. According to the story, Bobby refused to leave his owner's side and, until his own death on January the 14th, 1872, he would stay by Grey's graveside even in the most treacherous weather conditions. He was commemorated with a statue near the entrance to the graveyard. And that article was by Lucy Garcia. From the National, Thursday the 5th of October, from the news section, Rosyth, French port revealed as possible new destination, by Claire Buchanan. Hope remains high that a direct ferry service between Rosyth and Europe will come to fruition after the identity of a new prospective destination port was revealed. Plans for the revival of sailings from West Fife had stalled due to a lack of adequate berthing space in Zeebrugge. Last month, we reported that high-level talks are going on with another mainland port, which has now been identified as Dunkirk in France. Derek Sloan, director at Ptarmigan Shipping, who have signed an agreement with DFDS to further investigate the possibility of reopening the route, said that there was a great deal of effort going into the proposal, which has been named Project Brave. This weekend, Dunfermline and West Fife MP Douglas Chapman, who has been campaigning for the return of a ferry, welcomed the prospect of the link being created to France. Following the withdrawal of Zeebrugge, Derek has acted quickly to secure another port on the EU side, he said. Dunkirk is an even better option than Zeebrugge, as it has a higher level of security and customs, a fabulous terminal for passengers, and DFDS have already had a huge presence there, so they know the territory and have port networks in place. I remain hugely excited that this project will come to fruition. It's been a long haul with many unnecessary barriers put in our way, but to see Europe-bound ferries sailing up and down the Forth will be the culmination of a hard-fought campaign and, for me as a local MP, will mean every minute spent in the campaign will have been time well spent. The route from Rosyth was last opened to freight in 2018 when it was operated by DFDS, but a fire on board that ship hastened to end as the company could not find a replacement and lost all hope of turning around losses. The ferry last carried passenger services in 2010, 8 years after it first began sailing. And that article was by Claire Buchanan.
That concludes this week's edition of the National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Q and Review and tell your friends about our service.